This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good evening, everybody. This evening is sponsored in loving memory of Herbert Green, Zichron Levracha, by his family, who misses him dearly. And I want to thank Joyce Green, his wife, who's here with us with her granddaughter, Adina. Thanks for being with Grandma. I know she means a lot to her. And I want to thank Joyce for her ongoing support and participation. She's a big participant in our community education program, as are many of you. And we really appreciate you all learning with us all the time and supporting our Jewish education work worldwide. And Joyce has asked our board member Phil Schwartz to come up and say a few words in memory of Herb on her behalf tonight. Come on up, Phil. Here, watch out, maybe come around this way.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about Herb Green and why, when I was asked to speak about him, I not only felt happy to do it, but necessarily so. Herb Green is a Torontonian. I don't remember where he was born.
Detroit.
Not part of the Detroit gang. He was an engineer. He was a man who thought out of the box. He was responsible for developing a good hunk of Jewish Toronto real estate in the north part of Toronto. He was creative, he was original, and he was relentless. Relentless in the sense that when he wanted to do something or thought something was right, he would do it. He was not an Orthodox Jew, he was a good Jew. Not that Orthodox Jews are not good Jews. But he was tolerant, and he raised four families, and they all had different qualities, different outlooks, and different lives. But the important thing about him, he was passionate. He was passionate about his family, about his children, his grandchildren, and about the Jewish people. He was very upset with the evacuation of Gush Katif. He made a huge presentation to the Toronto Jewish community in which he put down a lot of money and said, I want this matched. And he was responsible, by his hard driving force, his sense of decency and accountability, in getting the City of Toronto Jewish community to support the Gush Katif, the people who were evacuated, to our regret when we look back in Jewish history. But now we have new circumstances which trump everything that went before it. That was so corny, I just had to say it. We don't know what's going to happen, but we have good Jews like Herb Green. I look forward to a very good future, and it's an honor to speak in his memory.
Moving swiftly along with the program, we have been so delighted by Dr. Rachel Karavim's lectures over the past, I think, 5 years, we can say now.
Yeah, I think so. I was looking back at my files.
Okay.
It says 2012.
There you go. So over the past 5 years here at Pardes, and year by year we see that class size grows and grows. And in fact, as we have promised, her course next year, instead of being in the rather claustrophobic room downstairs, her class is going to be moving up to the Beit Midrash because we simply cannot hold. Okay, so I can't compete with this fan club, so I'm just going to tell you that we can't wait for Rachel Karazin's course to start in the fall, but in the meantime, she is going to enrich our Yom Yerushalayim by teaching us about the poetry of Jerusalem. Rachel.
Shalom. Good evening. It's wonderful to come back here. What I'm going to say now is not a very polite thing to say, and yet I will say it not in a way of bragging, but in a way of sharing with you how important it was and it is for me to be here tonight. I accepted this engagement many months ago when my calendar was still empty for this week. And then the stuff will happen in Israel. They are not planning like Americans a year and a half ahead of time, like Pardes 6 months ahead of time. They're Israelis. And my daughter, where she works, is told that she needs to go for a whole week to Poland for professional development for a large organization she's working for. Nothing to do with Jewish history or Shoah. Other stuff. And my daughter is a single mom, and I'm the only Safta, and she lives in Hanaton. Yep, that's about 3 hours drive from here. And I'm there for the whole week so that Ronnie can continue her life. And I love being there, and I love being in Hanaton. But for me to come here tonight, I needed my husband to drive up to Hanaton to spend the afternoon and evening and part of the night with Tali, and for me to take the train, not the bus, being afraid of trumping things, and come from the southern side of the city and be driven all the way back. And I'm not bragging. I just want you to understand how I will not cancel a lecture at Pardes if it can be avoided. Okay, yala, let's go. How many people here really need for me to introduce myself? That they are here for the first time. Can I see a show of hands, please? Huh? Bruchim abaim. Thank you. So my introductions have become, I don't know, whatever, notorious, etc. Because I will not do the regular was born, went to school, went to some more school, that kind of thing. So you guys get three quick questions. What is it that you absolutely need to know about me without which my presentation doesn't make any sense to you tonight? And I'm an Israeli, you know that by my accent. You can ask anything. I don't want to address it. I will let you know. Go. First question, only first timers. What do you need to know about me? Yes, ma'am. No, my sister is. I can only read and talk about it. No, unfortunately, I'm not a poet. Thank you. Second question. Yes, sir.
Where did you study?
Where did I study? Well, the official stuff, everything.
Give me the question.
No. The officials, like BA, Master's, PhD.
Whatever you want.
Everything.
Yeah.
Well, listen, the thing that most have changed my life is the fact that when I was born in Kvutzat Geva in the year 1946, now you know how old I am, to parents who were Holocaust survivors, and they expected in the kibbutz, 25 years already, pioneers, lala, to immediately embrace Israeliness, and mom was pregnant, and for the baby to speak nothing but Ivrit, they taught me Hungarian. Can you imagine that? I mean, where did I study? I studied Hungarian in Kvutzat Geva in the years 1946, 7, and 8. A thing that for many years, if not hid, but almost, because it wasn't a great COVID to let people know that you, by speaking Yiddish or Hungarian or Polish, you belong to those people from over there. And then in the year 1990, when the communist regime falls, and I work for the Jewish Agency, I'm the only person in the education department that can speak Hungarian. And they sent me to Budapest to establish contact with a group of Jews there who were starting a Jewish day school, and that had totally changed my life. So I have a BA and a master's and a PhD. They are all from Haifa University. Even when I already lived in Yerushalayim, I traveled to Haifa. I like to travel. You can see that already. So, you know, like, where did I study depends what. Hungarian in the kibbutz when I was 1, 2, and 3. Okay? Totally changed my life. Last question. Done? Yes?
What do you love about Jerusalem?
I don't. I live in Tel Aviv. I'm a scuba diver, a swimmer, secular, left of center. They will not even have a place for me in Jerusalem. It's only Pardes that gives me a visa once a week to come here. I'm really mamash not Yerushalayim person, but I love the poetry and literature, and we will discuss it in a minute. And thank you for the question that allows me to be honest, and now you really know who I am. Okay. I also have a great chocolate mousse recipe that I'm not sharing. I'm also a scuba diver, and I also have 8 grandchildren, and I'm not showing pictures. Okay? Yala. Will you please turn for me to the cover page, all of you, and be as honest as you can? Well, I trust you all know who Herzl was. Yeah? Is that a good assumption? I'm going to make a big bet that most of you know who Yehuda Amichai was. Yeah, is there anybody who doesn't? It's okay not to know. We are here to study. Anybody for whom the name Yehuda Amichai is a novelty? What a pleasure to introduce you to Yehuda Amichai tonight. Great poet. We'll talk about him shortly. Now look at all the others. Avigdor Meiri, Meir Leil, and Esther Rab. And tell me honestly, how many of you had a chance to either listen or read any of their writings? One, two, okay. About under 10%, and you don't count, Jonathan. I don't count you. You're from a different planet. Okay. This was my hope, that I will be able, and this was my intention tonight, to offer a Jerusalem-focused Israeli literature and poetry session without doing the very, very, very obvious. We are not going to do Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. We are not. We are not even going to do Yerushalayim Shel Barzel. We shall not do Ammunition Hill. By the way, everybody coming from my full session, we will do all that and in depth, but not tonight. Tonight, I wanted to be challenging. Tonight, I wanted to push the envelope a little bit, to go into these fields of the not obvious, that which will not be screened last night on the walls of Jerusalem. To go a little bit on the side, to hear other voices, earlier voices, gone by voices. By the way, if I look carefully, none of the people we are reading tonight is alive anymore. So we are looking to older voices, we are looking to a little bit off the main track kind of voices. By calling this Jerusalem in Modern Israeli Literature, I already committed something very, very wrong by starting with Binyamin Zev Herzl, or Theodor Herzl, who was everything but an Israeli. But I wanted to set the tone for tonight by looking at a piece of probably one of the latest, not the last, but the latest, yet best known Herzl pieces, and yet I will challenge your honesty. Do we not all know that Herzl had written Altneuland? We do. Now, how many of us really remember what's written there? Yala. Anybody? Can I see a show of hands? Like, you really remember the story? One. Two, three, okay, so this is exactly what I was hoping for. To go that beyond that which we claim we know, but we actually don't. And I have this custom, this minhag for myself, that even when I teach something that I have taught a zillion times, and it will come down the road in a minute, one, the Yehuda Amichai poem that we will be reading, that I literally taught a zillion times, but even when I teach something that I know, I will always spend time on preparing, reading again. So, thank you. I read the whole Altneuland again, after many, many, many years that I have not touched it. And then I read around. And the interesting part for me was, because of some of the teaching and the reading that we have done together in the last couple of years, those of you who are with me in this teaching, that the year is 1902. I'd like to remind you how oftentimes when I speak about milestones, about what a divide points, I name the year 1903, not 1902, for two reasons. 1903 is the Zionist Congress number 6. So 1902 is 5, because we start in 1897. 1903 is the Kishinev pogrom, and the 6th Zionist Congress will come after the Kishinev pogrom. And when that happens in April, because Kishinev pogrom is Easter, and therefore it's very easy to remember the date, the Congress is in August. In those 4 months between, Herzl is scared. He is so scared and so disappointed of his efforts to get some sort of a certificate from some of the leaders of the world of that time, the Kaiser from Germany, or Franz Josef from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the Sultan for Turkey. Nothing happens. And then the pogrom, and the Kishinev pogrom up till the Holocaust, is the most horrible thing that collective Jewish memory has up till the Holocaust. And I always love to do the following, so I'll do it again. How many Americans of American descent in the room? Everybody is Israeli, of course. Can I see a show of hands for Americans? How many of the Americans can trace their roots in America to the first or the second decade of the 20th century? I want you to look around. That's Kishinev pogrom. That's Kishinev pogrom. That's the divide line that sent your grandparents there. Okay? Herzl will come up to the Zionist Congress in 1903, a year after this, and will put in front of the Congress what? Uganda. A mere year after publishing Altneuland, the big dream of the Jewish state in the land of Israel, in Yerushalayim, a mere year, and he is holding back, and he started talking, instead of the ideal that he had created in Altneuland a mere year before, he will say, hold it. It's not going to happen. Something horrible is happening in Europe. We need to find a safe haven for the night. When you grow up in Israel, and your children or grandchildren, if they do, the expression they will have to learn that Herzl is using, although he spoke in German, but we teach it in Hebrew, Miklat Lelaila. A safe haven for the night. That's the expression. And he will come forward with Uganda. Was Uganda accepted? So in spite of Herzl's despair, Altneuland was much stronger in catching the imagination. And Herzl will die a few months after the 6th Congress. And in an answer to the great loss, we'll have the beginning of the second Aliyah, that which will create Tel Aviv and the kibbutz and the Shomer and secular Israel as we know it. Not everybody was secular, not everybody built the kibbutz, but that's the main story, okay? So when we are touching on Altneuland, and I was looking for a Yerushalayim-related piece, I'd like you to sense the hour. Herzl at this point is really at the top of his hopes. This is what he wishes. This is what he dreams about. I will intercede here and there from later chapters because I didn't want too long a reading from that. I do want to do poetry. Let me remind you of the story. So there is this guy, benefactor, who wants to run, I should call it, a sociological experiment. And he invites this young man who has nothing much to do. Of course, everything is happening in Vienna. And he says to him, we're going to visit the Holy Land. And then we'll leave Europe and everything for 20 years. And we will come back in 20 years and we will see what transpires. So what we have now is these two gentlemen coming back from the 20 years of exile somewhere, and they're going to witness the success of Herzl's greatest dream. We've been moving the Jews from Europe. Herzl is not politically correct. there is no mention of Jews of other countries that need to move but the European ones. Okay? I think also his Beit HaMikdash music is all operas from Vienna. But that's from another story. So Altneuland, and we are reading the passage about Yerushalayim. 20 years before, King's Court and Friedrich had entered Jerusalem by night and from the west. So look a little bit of symbolism. It's pretty clear. It's not very deep, you know, heavy-duty symbolism. Because the image, the early image will be a sort of a night dark image. And it's correlated to the west because probably Herzl wants to suggest that the east is the hopeful, the east is the big thing, etc. Now they came by day, approaching from the east. Then she had been a gloomy, dilapidated city. Now she was risen in splendor, youthful, alert, risen from death to life. They came directly from Jericho up to the top of the Mount of Olives with this wide views. And her hills were still sacred to all mankind, still bore the token of reverence bestowed upon her through the ages. But something had been added, new, vigorous Jewish life. So Herzl in his Herzl in his imagination will see a merging of the ancient, which, by the way, he didn't like when he visited Eretz Israel. When you read Herzl's real impressions of Eretz Israel, he totally was disgusted by the old city of Jerusalem. For a Viennese gentleman like himself, and everybody from Hungarian origin, please excuse me, I remember that he was born in Budapest. I know that. Okay? But he's a Viennese gentleman, and the old city of Jerusalem, at the time when he visits, is really not to his taste. But in his creative work, Jerusalem now had merged the old and the modern, the new. Catching this moment of time, and I'll take the date of publication, it was probably written a year before, okay? But it's still the very beginning of the 20th century and the very end of the life of Herzl. And this is a world in which Middle East tensions do not exist. He's not aware of that. If you know your history of the Middle East, you will know that whatever causes the modern frictions as we know them will start with the Sykes-Picot Agreements, 1916, 14 years down the road. It's not on the horizon. He cannot even grapple with an image of all these nationalistic tensions imposed on tribal tensions, etc. None of that exists yet. The other thing is not on the horizon is, of course, the Holocaust. So we can visualize it's 1902. We are 31 years before the rise of the Nazis to power. Can you imagine a Holocaust? You cannot even imagine World War I. We are touching a world in which none of the things that had shaped our way of thinking, remember Auschwitz, don't give them arms from World War I, look at what happened in the Middle East and la la la, none of that exists. So this pure description of Jewish Jerusalem actually may seem feasible and plausible to his readership. The old city was in the walls as far as they could see from the mountaintop, had altered least. The Holy Sepulchre, the Mosque of Amal, and other domes and towers had remained the same. But many splendid new structures had been added. No, the naivete of that. How would you build many modern new structures in the old city of Jerusalem? I wonder who would let you and who would quarrel with whom about every inch. But in the imagination, everything can happen. That magnificent new edifice was the Peace Palace. A vast calm brooded over the old city. Outside the walls, the picture was altogether different. Modern sections intersected by electric street railways. Just put a check on everything that we do have, okay? Because there are not too many. So the electric railway, shall we say, the Yeno, you know, for one, okay? Wide, tree-bordered streets. Beseder? Check. A vast and broad, three-bordered street, homes, gardens, boulevards, parks, schools, hospital, government buildings, pleasure resorts. David pointed out and named the important building. David, by the way, is a very interesting literary figure because in the beginning of Altneuland, he's a poor beggar kid at the entrance to the restaurant where these fancy people are meeting. And the protagonist of the story takes pity over him and accompanies him home and gives him some money for food for himself and his ailing mother, etc. And this David will grow up to be a doctor, etc., because of the generosity of the main protagonist of the story. Okay, so he is leading the way. Jerusalem was now a 20th century metropolis. Publication, 1902. Writing probably just on the verge. So there is maybe this sense that Herzl had at the turn of the century that all of us had 17 years ago when we entered the new millennium and we were sort of wondering, is something going to be changed like drastically or whatever? It didn't. We were afraid of the crash of all our computers. You remember all that, the 2000 bug and whatever. None of that had happened. And probably changes do not happen like this. But Herzl coming back 20 years later, he can visualize this. So Jerusalem was now a 20th century metropolis. Fascinating indeed. But the old city drew their eyes back over ever and again. There she lay in the afternoon sunlight on the further side of Kidron Valley. Here I'm wondering, and if anybody is knowledgeable on that, because I could not find proof, how knowledgeable could Herzl be in biblical lore? Does he know the biblical stories of the Kidron Valley, of the other valleys around Jerusalem? I'm not sure. Let's leave him the benefit of the doubt, okay, that he knows something about it. King Kot had put all sorts of questions, and David had answered them all. Now he asked, what was that wonderful structure of white and gold whose roof rested on a whole forest of marble columns with gilt capitals? Friedrich's heart stirred within him as David replied, that is the temple. Take a minute here, because we have spent a lifetime talking about how secular Herzl had been, how he was really not connected to his Jewishness, how his all connection starts with the Dreyfus trial and with anti-Semitism, which is the worst entry into your Judaism. Why would a person so disconnected from their Jewishness visualize the building of the temple? On the other hand, maybe only a person totally disconnected from understanding the ins and outs of Jewish life can visualize that in 20 years, any group of Jews in the world will manage to agree on where, how, and what should be done as a third temple. So it works both ways. Herzl sees the importance of the temple, so he doesn't leave his dream Jerusalem only with a parliament and an opera house. He sees the need for a temple. Little does he know how unfeasible this would have been in real life. Like, can you imagine Jewish life of those years? Hasidim, Mitnagdim, Sfaradim, etc., Chalutzim, agreeing on what a new Beit HaMikdash should look like. And of course, the Viennese, all they wanted is probably a repetition of the Vienna Opera, I'm thinking, right? This is like their image of a temple. Okay. Friedrichshafen, that is the temple. Friedrich's first visit to the temple was on a Friday evening. David had engaged rooms for the party, one of the best hotels near the Jaffa Gate, nice, and at sundown invited his guests to go with him to the temple. Friedrich walked ahead with Miriam, David and Sarah following. The street, which at noon had been alive with traffic, were now suddenly stilled. Very few motor cars were to be seen. All the shops were closed. Slowly and peacefully, the Shabbat fell upon the bustling city. Leave all your cynicism aside, if that's possible for us. Is that a little bit close to reality, to what a Friday afternoon looks like in Jerusalem? Right? So we can make fun of Herzl and his understanding of reality, but a little bit of what he imagined actually did materialize. What can I tell you doesn't happen on my street in Tel Aviv, but I know that it does happen in Jerusalem. Okay? Very few motor cars, etc. Slowly and peacefully, Shabbat fell upon the bustling city. Throngs of worshippers wended their way to the temple and to the many synagogues in the old city and the new, there to pray to the God whose banner Israel had sung throughout the world for thousands of years. The spell of the Shabbat was over the holy city, now freed from the filth, noise, and vile odors that had so often revolted devout pilgrims of all creeds when, after long and trying journeys, they reached their goal. Here, Herzl is totally speaking about himself. Because if you read his diary from his visit to Jerusalem, this is exactly the words he was using. How vile and disgusting and disappointing it had been after his long voyage to come there. In the old days, they had had to endure many disgusting sights before they could reach their shrine. All was different now. There were no longer private dwellings in the old city. We have done some of that as we cleared the plaza in front of the Kotel. Okay? So this sense of too narrow, too crowded, needs space, had something to do with reality. The lanes and the streets were beautifully paved and cared for. All the buildings were devoted to religious and benevolent purpose, hospices for pilgrims of all denominations. Muslim, Jewish, and Christian welfare institutes, hospitals, clinics stood side by side in the middle of a great square was the splendid Peace Palace, where international congresses of peace lovers and scientists were held, for Jerusalem was now a home for all the best strivings of human spirit, for faith, love, and knowledge. Halevai b'yamenu amen. We have just little bits and pieces, but I'd like you to carry this with you, because dreams have a place in creating reality. And the State of Israel, as we know it, was first constructed in story and poem and prayer and Altneuland before it was ever rebuilt. We come from stories. We come from memories. We come from dreams. And this particular one had a solid place, although it was not all yet, if you wish, come true. But the ability to create such a vision, and think how many authors have created utopias, none of which ever happened at all. And we live a reality which is at least somewhat and absolutely in an articulated way is connected to this utopia. We are not there. And we were disagree probably about a zillion things. I cracked up laughing when I read about the services, and it was all arias from operas from Europe, like in the temple, okay? Which I'd like, based on the debate that we have today between Mizrahi music and Ashkenazi music, and all of us said, oy vey, I hope it is not read because it will just stir the fire. And yet, I don't think that we need to be ashamed. I don't think that we need to treat this as too naive, because the courage to put forward a dream and for it to be in discourse for quite a long time. By the way, what is the very first thing that comes into reality out of the book Altneuland? And it's not Jerusalem. I'm giving you a hint. Tel Aviv. What does Tel Aviv mean? Tel Alt. Aviv, New Neuland. The name of Tel Aviv is actually an adaptation of the Herzl title for his dreamland. So, you see, nothing too shabby. Okay, I'm going to introduce you to a gentleman called Avigdor HaMeiri. He was born towards the end of the 19th century in a small town, actually a village, that nobody have ever heard of in Hungary, in part of Hungary that now is the Ukraine, near Munkács in Hungarian, and now in Ukrainian Mukachevo. He is one of the earliest immigrants to the land of Israel after having fought in World War I. And his first book is about his experiences as a Jewish soldier in World War I, published here in Israel after his Aliyah. He starts being published in Hebrew in Hungary before his Aliyah in the early 20s. Then he makes Aliyah, and you can see his hand touch on almost everything that is cultural, both popular culture at the time and very serious culture. He will be the creator of the first two satirical theaters in mandatory Palestine, HaKumkum and then HaMatate, both of them dead. He will be the writer of many songs and poems sung by young and old. He will be the first translator of Ephraim Kishon, before Kishon can write Hebrew, and I could go on and on with his accomplishments. He starts ideologically on the Beitar side, right of center. He will shift almost totally to the extreme left, and he, in his last years, he establishes a very close connection to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So, you know, go figure. Go figure. Like, he really has it all, right? I mean, Shomer Tzair, Beitar, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe cannot do much more than that and be part of the Jewish world, right? Okay. One of the earliest poems that he creates is an adaptation of an older poem to which he gives words, is a poem that immediately is set to music, and it is about Yerushalayim. And I need for you to hear it, and I'll be watching carefully how many of you know it and can sing it. Because there was a time way before Naomi Shemer, that this was the anthem of Yerushalayim. Okay? All right, let's see how well we're doing. And then notice to what we are listening to, and then you will notice what we are not. From the... I am watching you. אשתחב אל החפיים מעל פסגת הר הצופים שלום לך ירושלים אלפי דורות חלמתי עלייך לראות, לזכות באור פנייך, ירושלים.
Yerushalayim Ha'ir Yonayich Libnech Yeru. You never heard it? Never heard it? Yerushalayim Chomotayich.
One more.
Pisgat Haratzofim Eshtachavelachapayim Pisgat Haratzofim Shalom Lach Yerushalayim.
We will stop here. I was watching all those who didn't look at the text when they were singing and knew the words, and there were quite a few. I must tell you that in my childhood, where Kiddush was celebrated every Friday evening, of course, of Shabbat, this was one of our Shabbat songs. And we would sing it at the Shabbat table. My mother loved it, and it became one of the zmiras at my home as I'm growing up. So I totally know it by heart. What I do not know, and I'm learning really lately with a friend who just published the first and only and very important PhD dissertation about Avigdor HaMe'iri, so many years after he had passed, that people were so in love with this totally committed love song from Yerushalayim, but they also edited the content. And those of you who know me will know that I, of course, will edit back everything that was edited out, because it tells you that Avigdor HaMe'iri is not your totally, I will bow down and love you forever, Yerushalayim. I love you, and yet I can see stuff. So why don't we start with the beginning? First of all, the point of reference. And this is the 20s. When an Israeli, if you want to say Eretz Israeli, writer of the time, is placing his point of view from Har HaTzofim, Mount Scopus, and not Har HaZeitim, and not Har HaBayit, what is the man saying? What is he saying in the 20s? Hebrew U. He's saying Hebrew University. In 1925, the Hebrew University is inaugurated. And already at that time, and the builders of it want to create, excuse the expression, this bipolar thing between Temple Mount, the temple, and the university. And Avigdor HaMe'iri, who is much more a university man, is placing himself on Har HaTzofim, Mount Scopus, Hebrew U, academia, but from there he is bending down and bowing to Yerushalayim, which is obviously Temple Mount, because if you stand on Temple Mount, you cannot see Temple Mount. If you stand on Temple Mount, you will bow to Har HaTzofim. So these two elements are there. I am Har HaTzofim, says Avigdor HaMe'iri. This is where my feet are. But I am not neglecting the other part. Okay? So, and it's wonderful to be able to teach this in Yerushalayim. I wonder what, I never taught this outside of Israel. What it will look like, do I have to bring a map, do I have to bring pictures to make people feel what is it, to which point of view you are looking at the city from. And actually the best place to look at Yerushalayim, I mean the old city and Temple Mount, is the Meyersdorf Terrace in Hebrew U on Mount Scopus. That really is your best view on the old holy city of Jerusalem. So Avigdor HaMe'iri is combining both. By the way, people knew that about Avigdor HaMe'iri. And when, after 67, we can come back to the Mount Scopus campus, and they will recreate the botanical garden on Mount Scopus, It now has an Avigdor HaMeiri lane that goes along the path for which at every point you could stop and bow down to Yerushalayim. At the entrance to the path, there is a stone with the words of the poem. Okay? So there are people who have not forgotten that although we have more modern layers, there have been songs in this country that almost equal Hatikva in their importance and their place. Now let's read, because Avigdor HaMeiri is not a person who will like make my our life easy. From the summit of Mount Scopus, I will prostrate myself to you. From the summit of Mount Scopus, O Jerusalem, peace unto you. For 100 generations I have dreamt of you, to marry, to cry, and behold the light of your countenance. Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, light up your face to your son. Ha'iri panayich libnech. The English expression light up is not exactly leha'ir panim, because the expression leha'ir panim in Hebrew, to light up your face, is to welcome. When you are welcoming somebody, you are supposed to leha'ir panim, to light up your face to them. So the Hebrew carries the double meaning, the light but also the sense of welcoming. Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, from your ruins will I build you. And there is indeed this sense of building already with Hebrew you in the 20s. And now comes the edited out part of Avigdor HaMeiri. I came here with a confident heart to rebuild your ruins. Yet how can I build your temple when there is no peace among your children? Sfardi, Ashkenazi, Yemenite, Falasha, Urfali, Georgian, Haredi, and liberal. Hey, it wasn't written last week. It was written 90 years ago. And it's all there. You come with the Herzl Neuland ideology to build a temple. He is totally in the footsteps of Herzl in the 20s. He had read the book. We are supposed to come here and make the dream come true in memory of the big father of Zionism. How can I do it? They're not even talking to each other. Look at the different groups. Is any of them foreign to you? Which one? Orphali. It's a group of... I had to look it up. Did I know? No, I had to look it up. So it's a Jewish community that comes from the southern part of Syria, bordering on Iraq. Okay? So that part of the world. And they are actually Orphali synagogues in Jerusalem. You can find them. And obviously they will not set foot in the other. And nobody will set foot in theirs, like in a good, which shows you how good Jews they are. Not the same. And therefore we don't set foot. Okay? Kurd is Kurd, Orphali is Orphali. We don't mix recipes. We don't set foot in each other's synagogue, and so on. Are you surprised by the Falasha Ethiopian? Yes. That they had already been here? Yeah, but these are the non-Jewish Ethiopians. And here is talking about quarrels among Jews. How we cannot talk to each other, and the total despair of the inability to make true the Herzl dream, not because of the Arabs, not because for lack of money, not because of nuclear bombs, because we are not talking to each other. That which Herzl so easily glanced over, Avigdor HaMeiri will bring to the surface. Hello? We're talking in terms of one people? Well, let me tell you, my greatest disappointments. From the summit of Mount Scopus, O Jerusalem, peace unto you. Thousands of exiles around the world raise up their eyes to you. In thousands of blessings may you be blessed, kingly sanctuary, royal city. We have to do something. There are thousands of people out there who would come if only you will make it. I think that the modernity, the fact that this is so relevant still today to our reality, is to me very, very amazing. I'm now starting to look more deeply into Avigdor Meiri, and maybe a session or a course will come out to that, because I think that people like yourself, you'll find your way to the Yerushalayim Shel Zahav and whatever, and maybe with a little bit of help and probing from me, we can look at some of the stepping stones on which those more modern poets have been standing, the shoulders of whom, before they brought us this. Please turn your attention to page 5. I will take comments on this one. Yes. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. This is what he is saying. Senseless hatred, sinat chinam, is still with us. And the same way, thank you for that, it had destroyed that temple, it is preventing a new one from being built. And this is like from 90 years ago. And if you look at my Facebook page, you will see some of that, and maybe some of yours as well. I will not do a Yerushalayim poetry session without one piece, at least, by Yehuda Amichai. This is my favorite all over. It's not one of his most famous one. It's not an Arab Shepherd Looking for a Kid on Mount Zion, etc., which we have studied a few times. I think I mentioned this probably in one of my sessions in my regular course. Excusez-moi, we'll do it again. And let me tell you, I think I've taught this over 200 times already, and every single time I can see something new in it. Before I go there, and with your permission, Green family, we have the ability to study this in English because of great translators. This morning, Hannah Bloch had passed away. She is one of the best-known translators of Yehuda Amichai. So what may we study just this poem in her memory tonight, next to your late husband's memory. Thank you. So this is indeed in memory of Hannah Bloch, back there in Berkeley. Actually, Oakland, I think. I think she is from Oakland. Okay. The year is 1985, by which time Yehuda Amichai is already a well-known poet. So unlike some of the poems of Yehuda Amichai that we all like to study, that are very, very early, like God Has Mercy Over Kindergarten Children, etc., from 48, or the very, very new, It Is Sad to Be the Mayor of Jerusalem, etc., etc., the later ones of his life, this is like smack in the middle. And unlike other collections of Yehuda Amichai poetry that are normally chronological, in this one, he had collected earlier and slightly later poems that are related to Yerushalayim. And the book is published in 1985, so we are well into the post-67 era. And it was published in what I like to call three languages, Hebrew, English, and photography. It has beautiful black and white pictures. It's not available anymore. When on Amazon, they will sell you poems of Jerusalem by Yehuda Amichai, it doesn't have the photography anymore. You'll have to look for that in some old bookstores if you can, and I highly recommend you do. For me, this is a key poem. For a voice that is already heard loud and clear here in the state of Israel, using Jerusalem as the litmus test of how we treat the whole land of Israel, and opening a conversation that today is like out there and being yelled, but in the 80s is very fresh and new. And I want for us to be able to touch that beginning point of that discourse. But before that, I need two volunteers. I always do this shtick. I need somebody who has good Hebrew and who is not a rabbi, because I will ask a question and I will need a one-word yes or no answer. And therefore, please not a rabbi, because I don't want the it depends. I need the yes or no. So anybody fluent in Hebrew who can give a straight, quick answer to a question. Can I see a show of hands? Okay, not a rabbi. Okay, I'm asking you to look at the Hebrew title of the poem. Will you do that? I'm asking you now to look at the English translation of the title of the poem and tell me whether the translation is correct. It is not correct. Thank you very much. Now I need something more complicated. I need somebody who has no Hebrew, but somebody, and I know in this room you are many, who is comfortable in Jewish life, attend synagogue, I'm not checking how many times, goes to the ceremonies, knows the bless, la 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 la, okay? But no Hebrew. Anybody like that? Anybody like that? No Hebrew or very little Hebrew? No? Yala, be courageous. Be courageous. Will you do that for me? And your name is Mrs. Green? Okay, Doris, okay. So, Joyce. Joyce, here is the deal. I am going to read to you the Hebrew title. Now, you know me. And if you don't, I'm telling you. I'm a Sabra of 71 years. I have fluent Hebrew. I know what it means. I do not need for you to translate it to me. No. I need for you to respond to the sound. I'll be reading the Hebrew slowly. Don't even look at it. Just listen to me and tell me if the sound reminds you of anything. Okay? I'm going to do the Hebrew. You're listening, Joyce?
No.
You're with me? Mishirei Eretz Tzion v'Yerushalayim. Eretz Tzion v'Yerushalayim. Does it ring a bell? What does it sound like? No, you're translating.
No.
I'm just asking, does it remind you of anything? I'm now going to do the thing that you will all regret having made me do. And I will sing. Eretz Zion v'Yerushalayim. So Amichai in his title line is suggesting to the Hebrew reader, I'm going to have a conversation with Hatikva. I'm going to maybe mess with Hatikva. I'm going to deal with things important and maybe treat them a little bit less than respectfully. So beware. Also underneath is another chutzpah element. And these are the letters Kaf Aleph. In what kind of books do sections have titles like Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, Kaf Gimel? Tanakh, Psalms, Tehillim, etc. Now I need the attention of all people connected to the United States, coming from there, living there, going back there, whatever. Look at the English title. From the Songs of Zion the Beautiful. This is Chana Bloch, Zichrona Livracha. This is Chana Bloch of blessed memory. Not doing a simple translation, but creating for the American reader a cultural adaptation. Reminding them of America the Beautiful, just like Amichai is talking to the Hebrew readership, Mishirei Eretz Zion v'Yerushalayim. Okay? Now this poem, because I'm going to use it for my actual most important purpose in life, and that to use the most important and best tool in Jewish education, which is guilt. I will use this poem to show you how much is lost in translation. How much more the Hebrew can carry, you are not even getting an inkling of, in the English. And I will handhold you through it so that when next we meet, your Hebrew is better. We are going to read this in Hebrew. I'm going to read this in Hebrew, and then we'll do the whole discussion in English. Yes? I cannot hear you. Oh, yes. And I will open the discussion with the last line, where there is a difference between the Hebrew and the English that Amichai had agreed to. Okay? So just bear with me. This is a tricky one. And we are going to use it like a Gemara page. Look at every word here. Yerushalayim, makom shehakol zochrim sheshechechu bo mashu, ach im enam zochrim ma shechechu. ולצורך זכירה זו אני חובש על פניי את פני אבי. זוהי עירי שבה מתמלאים כלי חלומותיי כמו מחלי חמצן של צוללים לצלול. הקדושה בה הופכת לפעמים לאהבה, והשאלות ששואלים בהרים האלה נשארו כתמיד, ראית את הצון שלי? ראית את הרועה שלי? ודלת ביתי פתוחה כמו קבר שמתוכו קמו לתחייה. Jerusalem is a place where everyone remembers he has forgotten something, but doesn't remember what it is. Now, חברים, do you need to be rabbis or biblical scholars in order to understand that if a Hebrew Jewish poet of Jerusalem is using the first three lines of his poem, and in them he puts together the words Yerushalayim, remembering and forgetting, but the gentleman may be making an allusion to a slightly earlier text, like 3,000 years earlier. What's the allusion? Yerushalayim, remembering, forgetting. Im eshkachech, sounds, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem. Now the next question, I have hinted at it. Is Amichai being disrespectful of Psalms? Because back there in Psalms that we all hold and believe that was written and left for us by King David, he is making a commitment that we keep repeating ever since. God forbid I should forget Yerushalayim. My hand, my arm will wither, my tongue, you know, horrible stuff. And here comes Amichai with this flippant Israeli tone and goes, well, I'm not so sure anymore. People come here to Yerushalayim, they look around, they may say, I have this deja vu thing, but I'm not sure what it is. And my question to you is, who is Amichai talking about? Who are those people who, when they come to Yerushalayim, have a sense that they ought to remember something, but they don't have it anymore? It's not there. They don't know what it is. Chilonim, it's about us Tel Aviv people, huh? Yeah, I love this. Always happens when I teach it in Yerushalayim. Always does. I can live with that. Okay. Another answer that I will always get when I teach groups who come visiting from Chutz La'aretz, they will tell me, it's about us, diaspora Jews. It's you Israelis being critical of us. Well, I've got news for you. It's neither about Tel Aviv people, nor about Chilonim, nor about diaspora Jews, although I love the guilt, but it doesn't work in this poem. Because Amichai is talking about himself. He who lives in Mishkenot Sha'anim, facing the walls of the whole city, a master of the Hebrew language, fluent in biblical text, fought in many of the wars. And he says, I need to do something in order to remember. And for the sake of remembering, I wear my father's face over mine, in order to better remember what it is that I may have forgotten. I need Abba's face over mine. Oy. Amichai is an Israeli from age 12. His father was a diaspora Jew. What is he saying? That generation of German Jews, European Jews, diaspora Jews have something over us Israelis? that without their face, their eyes, their feeling, we will never get it. Yeah, what could they have over us? Pardon?
Dreams.
Longing. Not taking it for granted. And now look at the trickery and the beauty of the Hebrew. Those of you who have knowledge of the grammatical structure, Amichai is not saying in Hebrew, "Kedei lizkor." Remind me again quickly, what was it? He says, "Lezorch zechira." It's the description of the activity, Shema Peula in Hebrew, Ulpan coming up. It's the hard work of remembering. I wear my father's face over mine. So we established that Amichai is totally cognizant of the fact that in spite of his almost Sabra being, fluency in Hebrew and in biblical stack, paying taxes, living in Yerushalayim, fighting in all the wars, he still needs his father's eyes, etc., to better understand this place. How popular does a statement like this make Amichai in Jerusalem, in Israel? When he's suggesting to his Hebrew-reading Israelis that the generation of his father, those diaspora exile Jews, have something over us Israelis. How popular does a statement like this make Amichai among Israeli Sabras who love Amichai? So where's the lady who is learning Amichai for the first time? So the first thing you need to remember about Amichai, that being popular is not his goal. Okay? Take that with you. And now the intricacies of language. In Hebrew and in English. In English, you wear everything, right? Your shoes, your socks, your blouses, your jewelry, your glasses, your headgear, and even your perfume. In Hebrew, bless the language. We gorev our socks, we noel our shoes, we lovish our slacks, we markiv our glasses, we chovish our headgear, we ode our jewelry, and for perfume we don't have, so we go to the Yiddish and spritz. Now, Amichai wants to describe an activity that doesn't exist in the language. People normally do not wear faces over their faces. So therefore, he doesn't have a verb. He needs to look at the whole plethora of verbs available to him for stuff you put on your body, and he's choosing the chovish. Which is like most Israeli Hebrew verbs, has three letters as its root. Chet, bet, shin. So first of all, lechvosh kova, cover your head. Is Amichai suggesting, even symbolically, to his Israeli, mainly secular readership, that in order to understand Yerushalayim, act Jewish man, cover your head. Maybe. But the verb carries much more with it. How many of you have traveled in Israel at the time when you still needed paramedics on the buses? What do you call a paramedic in Hebrew? A chovesh. Chovesh is somebody who dresses your wounds. So the verb, root, contains in itself the sense of healing, of setting right, of dressing a wound. And if I took you to the beginning of the 20th century, to the Hebrew of Bialik, when he's talking about students in the yeshiva, he will say, Chovesh et safsalei beit hamidrash, dresses the benches of yeshiva, namely studying. And if I took you all the way back to Jeremiah, he will say, Chavush bevet haasurim, committed to prison. Amichai's choice of verb that will help him remember includes the sense of act Jewish, cover your head, study,
heal, commit. And the English says, I wear my father's face over mine. How do they say in nice American movies? I'll rest my case. Two other quick examples. My father's face. The English face from the Latin facade, outside. The Hebrew panim, inside. You wear your father's face, but actually you connect. The Hebrew language recognizes that your face is nothing but the expression of who you are inside. And last but not least, and with this I do invite everybody who has the exact connotation in Midrash. It is said about Joseph, at the moment of temptation by the wife of Potiphar, what does the Midrash say? He saw the face of his father. So your father's face is actually the litmus test of behavior. And now with the chutzpahdik, very practical reading of Rachel Korozin, I'm going to ask, and don't answer, it's just a rhetorical question. Is it not true that many of us already have passed that corner in life when you walk by a window or a mirror and suddenly you see your mother's or father's face there? Had the moment come already? Not yet. When it will, first time it's annoying. First time it's terrible. Like, what is mom doing in my bathroom every morning? But after that, and when they are gone, is Amichai suggesting that in order to better understand this city, you need to mature a little bit? You need to start looking like your father. You need to start being that person, carrying with you all of that in the one line, Ani chovesh al panai et pnei avi, I wear my father's face over mine. As soon as you have done that, suddenly everything becomes crystal clear. This is the city where my dream containers fill up like divers' oxygen tanks. Aha! Now I get it. I need Yerushalayim as much as a scuba diver would need to take those tanks with oxygen to go underwater. This is as much as I need it. How many scuba divers in the room? Okay, I need you guys. There is a mistake in the poem. What do we scuba divers carry in those tanks when we go down? Compressed air. You cannot breathe oxygen. Oxygen they give you in the tanks in hospital. When you're breathing is kacha kacha, and you need a little bit extra, they'll give you oxygen. Now a story. I told it, I don't know how many times, and I will yet tell it again, because it's a moment in my life as a teacher. It's the mid-90s. Amichai is still around. And I work for the Jewish Agency in Kiryat Moria, not far from here. By the way, this is the time I get to know Pardes, because I was in the section where the little money that we gave you from the Jewish Agency was on my budget line, so I had to come and visit. And one of my colleagues, not me unfortunately, I'd love to take credit, was organizing a professional development day for all of us. And to culminate it all, she had invited Yehuda Amichai to read to us one of his poems. Not this one. And it was still from a piece of paper, handwritten. Okay? It was a moment. It's all done, it's the end of the day, that was like the maftir, you know, we finish. And I repeat, I, the idiot, remember that, go up to him and say, Mr. Amichai, in that other poem about Yerushalayim, you had made a mistake. I did that. I'm not proud of it. It's over 20 years ago, so I have the excuse of age, maybe, but I did it. It's not oxygen, it's compressed air, which in Hebrew is avir dechus. Man looks at me pitifully, which is exactly what I deserved. and says, like in English it will sound nice, like who cares, but in Hebrew it was mechpatli, which is who cares, but only a little bit more colloquial. And then he added my lesson. It's so much more beautiful like this. Which had sent me back to the poem to look at the classical every teacher question. What did the poet mean when he said it's so much more beautiful like that? And I went to the Hebrew and now listen. Divers oxygen tanks. Listen to the Hebrew. Oxygen chamtsan. Mechalei chamtsan shel tzolelim litzlol. He wanted the tzolele sound, which in Hebrew is litzlol, go deep, but also tzlil, sound, and also tzalul, because it's Yerushalayim avirarim, tzalul kayayim, see-through, transparent. And I wanted him to say compressed air. Like, I mean, how stupid can you be? But also now let's go back to the poem and not to my stories about how Amichai can work the magic of the Hebrew language. Because none of that, Mechalei chamtsan shel tzolelim litzlol. You have the sound, you have the depth, you have the see-through. And now, all of those of you who still remember literature classes back in school, and who can count quickly until 14, they will know that this is a sonnet. And when you read a sonnet, you know that when you have reached the center, the middle, there'll be a shift in tone. The woman is nodding. Are you a literature teacher? Student? Okay. And the tone has shifted. You remember, those of you who study with me, how many times I physically teach you an Amichai poem, and then I say, and now the poet is stepping aside, and he's making a different comment. So we had the wow moment, total revelation. This is how much I need the city, like air to breathe. And then immediately after that, standing aside, looking at it, הקדושה בלפעמים הופכת לאהבה. Its holiness sometimes turns into love. And by virtue of that, if only sometimes it turns into love, what can happen all those other times? It sometimes turns into love, and sometimes indifference, and sometimes anger, and sometimes fun. Jerusalem can be many things to the same person on different days, on different hours. And now the commitment is there. It doesn't say sometimes it's holy. No, he said it's always holy. I understand my commitment. Hakdusha ba, the holiness in it. But that kdusha sometimes, my goodness, can turn sour. This is the 80s. We didn't even start having that multi-narrative discourse about Israel. Only Avigdor Meiri in the 30s or the 20s. But we were all still under the great impression of total love and no critique. And Amichai already is bringing into it the language. And look at where he does the split between Kedusha and Ahava. Because if you remember your Birkat Kohanim, the blessing of the Kohanim, when they say Baruch Atah Adonai, Shekidshanu beKedushato shel Aaron, who had given us, blessed us with the Kedusha, the holiness of Aaron. So the Kohanim are standing there, they are going to do their bracha, and they start by saying, thank you God, Toda Rabba, you know, from Aaron HaKohen all the way to me. Thank you, I got it. And now comes the other side. Once you have recognized the Kedusha, וציוונו לברך את עמך ישראל באהבה. Now it's commanded upon us to bless this congregation with love. Kedusha you get. Holiness you get. Ahava needs to come from you. And sometimes you can, and sometimes you cannot. Yerushalayim is complicated, says Yehuda Amichai. והשאלות ששואלים בהרים האלה and the questions that are asked in these hills are the same as they have always been. Have you seen my sheep? Have you seen my shepherd? And just look at the multiple levels of the questions. Because in this city, sheep and shepherds can be on the very practical, smelly, ba-ba Bedouins who linger into the city or the borders of the city, and they are looking maybe for their sheep. And sheep and shepherd can be a metaphor for leadership and the people. And my goodness, in the city, we both look at our leaders, say, hello, do you still see us? And they occasionally, at least every few years, have to see and check whether we still follow them. But sheep and shepherd are always also the metaphor for the ultimate relationship between God and us people. And do we not occasionally find ourselves at moments that we need to ask, hello, you still see me? And maybe Amichai ventures in a chutzpedig Israeli way. Maybe he too is looking down on us and asking, hello, you still with me? Are we still together? Or have you strayed too far away from me? Do you still recognize the Kedusha? Look at what complex language of Yerushalayim discourse. And over 30 years ago, he just set us on the way. And now comes the enigmatic line. V'delet beiti petucha, and the door of my home, of my house, is open like a tomb where someone was resurrected. Why, do I ask myself, would a person want to equate their home to a tomb? Why do they need to think of their home as a place from which Geula will start, שמתוכו קמו לתחייה? Is Amichai in the footsteps of the cookie and Geula thing, the Zionism, the practical Zionism, is the beginning of אחרית הימים? Maybe. I've lost my only chance to find out, because I asked that other stupid question. I should have asked this. But there is even a more complicated question here. And that is the tension between Amichai and his translator and that which he must have agreed to. The Hebrew is שמתוכו קמו לתחייה. קמו is plural. Kamu is the many. And the image of rising from the dead for the many is Jewish. Is ours. You go to the English, where someone was resurrected. My goodness, that is not Jewish. One?
No, why?
No, go waste your question on stupid things. And I was planning to ask the translator, and now that is gone as well, as of today. So we will never know. Let's remain with the question. Was Amichai thinking about universal readership when he allowed that English translation? Did he want to hint to those who are waiting for the resurrection of the one in the English while keeping the many for the mishpoche? You know, we will never know, but look at the complexity and the language of being able to have a Jerusalem discourse that is versed in text, yet questioning, having a bit of chutzpah, playing around with imitating an anthem maybe with many, many question marks, opening up through translation to other cultures, all in a one short 14-line poem. And now we have 5 minutes, so here is the deal. We are going to read the Esther Rab and not Midrash Yonati. We are going to do that because Midrash Yonati needs much more than the 5 minutes that I have. I want you to know that I found a whole Gemara-like 2 pages in which Midrash Yonati is in the middle and all the textual references all around. We are going to do that in my course this fall. Yonatan, you have it? Okay. Because I was thinking of a copy for you just in case you didn't. I want you to go now to the last page, page 9, and I want to introduce to you Esther Rabb. Now, I know you will excuse me for doing it intentionally, but I didn't know, honest to God, that she too was from Hungarian descent. I honest to God, didn't know it, but she is. What's so special about Esther Rabb, so little known? So little known. Page number 9. Saftot Kdoshot Yerushalayim, Esther Rabb. Like Avigdor Meiri, born in the last decade of the 19th century, lived in Israel until the 80s. Now that they are coming back to research her poetry, she got the amazing title of the first Sabra woman poet. Yeah, I know you know about Rachel, I know you know about Leah Goldberg, but they were not born in the land of Israel. She was. She belongs to the generation that is post-Bialik, but she doesn't like Alterman and Shlonsky. And we all will say, you know, there was Bialik and Chernichovsky, and then came Alterman and Shlonsky and Leah Goldberg. And she's somewhere in between there. She actually mocks their diasporic voice, their imitation on French and Russian and German literature, while hers comes from Petah Tikva. She's the child, the one daughter next to three brothers, of one of the founders of Petah Tikva. It may yet be that she is not 100% sure about her sexuality. There's lots of references to how she wishes she was a man, which at the time is not very popular. I'm not going into the gender thing now, right now, and into her erotic poetry. She's most famous for her unbelievably beautiful, minute description of the landscape of the land of Israel at the time. And she, in her poetry, can differentiate between the different birds, like ankor, vedror, bulbul, etc. Like, do we really know the differences between all of them? But she lives very, very close to nature. She's not a Yerushalayim person. She is born in Petah Tikva, lived for a bit in Cairo, then for many years in Tel Aviv, and then finished her life in Kiryat Tivon up north. Okay? And yet she is very secular in her way of life. Yet, like many Israelis born and raised in this country, totally conversant in biblical law. Because that we know. And the land. And now she creates an interesting tension between Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim that we normally... I know what we see normally, like the Chilonim and the... No. Hers is very different. Holy grandmothers in Yerushalayim, may your virtue protect me. So the language is totally respectful, totally looking up like Avigdor Meiri from Mount Scopus at those grandmothers of Yerushalayim. She's totally respectful of them. And they're virtuous. And she knows that. And she wants to be protected. Why? Because she does not belong there. The smell of blossoms and blooming orchards I suckle with my mother's milk. Feet soft as hands fumbling in the torrid sand. And tussled in eucalypti, leaden with bees and hornets. All my life is not this Jerusalem grandmother's life. My life is sand and nature and tussles and walking barefoot and the plants. I can just think of you, holy grandmothers of Yerushalayim, from afar. You were not part of my life. Whisper the lullaby to me, not you, Saftut. The plants and the trees and the nature. 7 times shall I steep myself in the Mediterranean. My mikveh is the seashore. Going to the beach, going to the sea, a totally antithetic topic to Yerushalayim, whose dwellers, as we all know, cannot even swim. For what do you go to the mikveh of the Mediterranean? To prepare for King David, my beloved. Which is an imagery thing. She is never going to mamash meet King David, of course. And they shall go up to him in glorious dignity to the mountains of Jerusalem. I shall sit with Deborah under the date tree, have a coffee with her and talk. Can you see how she deals with all these biblical sacred figures like friends, like part of her life? About war and defense, holy grandmothers in Jerusalem, the aroma of Shabbat candles and naphtaline. Not nice. Not nice. You smell to me of... It's the material that you put in the clothes to protect them from moths. Okay? It's smelly and disgusting every summer when you take them out from the winter. So Jerusalem smells to her like old, and Shabbat candles and naphtaline are not her Israeli Jewishness. The seashore and the stories of Deborah and King David and swimming and walking. But you still look at Yerushalayim, you know the grandmothers are there, and you still want to be protected by them. I think we will finish here, and thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.